State of Ohio. He served our nation, the United States House of Representatives, for 6 terms. In addition to his long list of both private and government achievements, he was elected to the U.S. Congress on the Select Committee on Intelligence, which oversees all of our national secrets, as well as his service to the House Committee on Rules, which presides over all legislation regarding Congress. He has served as a special presidential envoy to President Ronald Reagan and President George H. Bush. He has served as a United States representative to the European Parliament. He has also served in a variety of political and military negotiations. Congressman Bob McEwen's legislation, which was approved by the U.S. Congress, included National Strategic Act, which involved the command of direct military operations in the theater of command, which was recognized by Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney and General Norman Schwarzkopf during the operations of Desert Storm. He graduated from the University of Miami with a bachelor's degree in business administration. Congressman Bob McEwen and his wife, Liz, have 4 children, and we are very blessed to have him with us tonight, I have to tell you. Met him a couple times before, but in this visit that we have with him today, the 4 of us, Lisa and I and Liz and Bob, getting together and talking, it's a lot of fun because our mouths start going. We get so passionate and get excited about this nation that it is an absolute true honor. Those of you, by the way, have met him before, who went on our God and American Heritage Tour down the east coast of the United States when Congressman Gary Miller could not get us into the Capitol building that day. At the last minute, Congressman Miller couldn't make it. It was Congressman Bob McEwen that stepped in and got us into the U.S. Capitol. And so those of you, many of you who went on that tour, will remember him very affectionately. So please give a warm welcome, a grateful welcome to Congressman Bob McEwen tonight.
Thank you. Thank you, Alden. Thank you also very, very much. I am pleased and honored to be in such a distinguished group, to be here at the Calvary Chapel here in Chino Hills, but also for all of you that have served our country. And I am pleased to have joined with the many in this room that applauded your service. Thank you for coming tonight. I feel a little bit like the mule that the farmer got entered in the Kentucky Derby. And everybody laughed at him. He said, you know, your mule has no chance of winning. He says, I know that, but he'll be in some mighty fine company. And so I just feel like tonight I'm in some mighty fine company, and I'm just thrilled to be with you. The Bible says repeatedly, remember the former times. Woodrow Wilson said, a nation that doesn't remember what it stood for and from whence it came cannot know who it is or where it is going. And so I think it's appropriate that we just take a couple of minutes to respond to the idea as to what America is. Is it unique? If it is, what makes it unique? How did that impact 9/11? And how does that rest upon us? You know, half of the people in the world today live on less than $2 a day. Half of those, that'd be a fourth, live on less than $1 a day. A fourth of all the people in the world, 330,000 of them, 330 million of them, that's more than all the people in North America, 330 million of them live in China on less than $1 a day. We like to talk about poverty in this country. I think it's appropriate that we kind of put it in perspective just a bit. If we want to talk about poverty, we'll say, well, you know, those poor folks in the Ozarks over there in Arkansas, you know, they have a hard time of it in America. Do you know Pakistan is the 5th or 6th largest country on earth, 168 million people. The total wealth generated by the nation of Pakistan, 168 million people, is less than the GDP of the state of Arkansas. 4th largest nation on earth is Indonesia, 278 million people. You and I talk about, you know, in Louisiana, we saw it on the television. You know, down there in the Ozarks, there, down there in the bayous of New Orleans, you know, not everybody's wealthy in America. The entire GDP, the entire gross domestic product, the entire wealth generated by the 4th largest nation on earth, Indonesia, is less than the gross domestic product of the state of Louisiana. So, well, what about the Ozarks? You know, the Okies, you know, that's kind of struggle there. There's 3 million of those. The total wealth every year is greater than the entire 91 million people in the Philippines. You know, when we want to talk about poverty, this is the place that people hope to someday escape to. Our definition is so skewed. We talk about all of the wealth in the Middle East, with all those Arab countries with all their oil. If you take all that oil and all the wealth generated by the 26 Arab countries, the entire gross domestic product of all of their wealth is less than half as large as the GDP of the state of California. And so when these folks want to talk about how awful it is here, well, his name was Eddie Segamonians. Showed up on the front pew of our church. We said, Eddie, how'd you get here? Well, he was working in Iran, and the fellow working next to him said, Eddie, it looks like those folks are going to take over, and they'll kill a lot of people when they do, and I'm leaving. And before I leave, here's a map of the United States of America, and here is a place called Ohio, and here in southern Ohio is a little place called Hillsboro, the center of the universe. He said, my father owns the Parker Hotel in Hillsboro, Ohio. And if you can ever make it to America and you ever make it to, you can make it to Hillsboro, my father will give you a roof over your head and a bed to sleep in. Well, government collapsed. Fortunately, you and I have never experienced what it's like when there's no right or wrong. People can do anything they want. They can come in and steal, rape, burn, pillage, ride around on the hoods of their cars, shoot people if they choose to. They came looking for Eddie. He had sold his car for $3,000, which he kept on his pocket at all times. His mother called. He said, Eddie, they're looking for you. He had a name that was a Christian name, and they were going to get rid of him. And so he made it to the airport in Tehran, Iran. It was 12 o'clock. At 1 o'clock, there was a flight to London. At 2 o'clock, there was a flight to New York. He said, I'll take the flight to London. He got on. It was the last flight to leave Tehran after the Islamic Revolution. He made it to London. He made it to America. He made it to Hillsborough. He made it to the front pew of our church with a clothes on his back and $3,000 in his pocket. Well, some of us co-signed to get him a job mowing the lawn at the airport, and Liz and I had him paint our house, and he's now married. He lives just about 3 miles from here, where he's married and has 3 children. Where is the place that people hope to someday escape to? This nation has been lovingly handed to us. Final point on this. We have a level below which we will not permit a person to sink. That is, if you walk into this country, sit down on a park bench, put your feet up, we'll educate your children, give you unlimited access to free health care as much as you can consume. We will give you a roof over your head. We'll give you stamps for food. We will give you a place to stay. The second richest nation on earth, spot on earth, is Western Europe, France, Germany, Britain. A person on welfare in the United States is more likely to have a telephone, a television, an air conditioner, an automobile, eats more meat, and has more square footage space than the average resident of the second richest spot on earth, Western Europe. Now, the question might fairly be asked, why? Why is that? 4% of the population of the world. Why is it that this place invented the airplane, the light bulb, the phonograph, the telegraph, the telephone? Why is it that more inventions out of this 4% of the population of the world than the other 96 combined? Why is it more copyrights, more books, more plays, more symphonies than the rest of the world combined? There is something special about this place, and if you and I do not know what it is, then we can have it stolen or moved away from us, and we'll never know what happened. And that's why I commend Jack and Lisa and all of you for remembering the former ways. The United States of America is recognized for its righteousness. When the Israelis and the Egyptians wanted to sign an agreement, they needed some place of standard that they could say that, see, look what we're doing, a place that is fair. So would we go to the United Nations? Well, that's ridiculous. Would we go to Paris? Would we go, where did they want to go? They wanted to go to the lawn of the White House of the United States of America. Because people know that if you can appeal to them, that's where stability, that's where peace is. If a plane is leaving from Uganda and flying to Thailand and gets shot down, to whom would they look for help? They would turn, fortunately, there are 420,000 Americans that wear the uniform of the United States Air Force, and they know that those people would protect and find out who did that to the skies to keep them safe for the entire world. Japan. Japan imports 100% of its oil. has to all be transported across the Pacific. Suppose a ship is being hijacked on the high seas, pirated. To whom can you appeal? Who could you rely upon? Who could you trust? Denmark, it's got entire navy, consists of 3 minesweepers. So to who, as it happened over 300 times last year on the high seas, who can you turn to? Fortunately, there's 780,000 Americans that wear the uniform of the United States Navy. That's why there's peace and stability in the world. The scripture says that if you take a city, you have to bind the strong man. And for those that wish to bring chaos on this planet, there's one nation they have to go through first. And that makes you and me a target. Therefore, we need to understand what makes us as blessed as we are and how we preserve it. And so let me just run through a couple of thoughts. First of all, America is wealthy because of a system of government that some folks got together. And let me just back up here real quickly because we're at the end already and we're not supposed to be there yet. That is, I'm going to share with you just about all of the economics you'll ever need to know in just about 5 minutes. If you look at that chart, it says it goes from 0 to 100. And I take it by faith that it will appear. And on either side of it, I can see it perfectly right here. I just feel sorry. And so let us use our imagination just a bit. Let us suppose that there's a chart. Visualize with me if there's a chart. And it goes from 0 to 100. And we'll say 100 is everything that you earn. That's everything that you've ever earned, 100% of your income. Let us suppose that I come along and I take 25% of it away from you. What happens? 2 things happen. Number one is you have fewer choices and a lower standard of living. Now, Thomas Jefferson said freedom is having choices. When I take choices away from you, you lose your freedom. Anybody who has a teenager understands this. I want to make my own choice. I want to do it my way. I can't make my own decisions. That's right. That's the way it works. The more I take away from you, the fewer choices you have, the less freedom. Suppose I take 50% of it away. What happens? 2 things. Fewer choices, lower standard of living. Suppose I take 75% of it away from you. Even fewer choices and lower standard of living. Now, who can take money away from you? Only 2 people. Only 2. One is a criminal, has a gun, and can come up and take money away from you. The other is the government has a gun and can come up and take money away from you. Now, what's the point? The impact is the same. Fewer choices and a lower standard of living. And so you show me, of all the nations on earth, I don't need to know the name of the country, you show me what percentage of the gross domestic product of that nation is controlled by government. And here's a principle. The greater the freedom, the greater the wealth. The greater the government, the greater the poverty. And politics is very simply this, very simply. Where do we go on that chart? Now that you know it, I can blindfold you, and we can go, we fly, and we can land down in Tegucigalpa, and you can go drive around Honduras for an hour, and then we'll get up and we'll go to Buenos Aires and do the same thing, and then we can go to Nairobi, and then we can go to St. Peter, and you'll be able to look around in whatever nation, you can see the level of poverty and the level of wealth, the level of freedom. And that's what makes America wealthy, is because it is free. Now, all right, you say, I majored in economics, and professors would say, no. America's rich because they just work hard, and they're really smart, and they got lots of natural resources and a temperate climate. Okay, what about Korea? Korea is a peninsula. Same language, same culture, same heritage, same everything, except that at the 38th parallel after the Korean War, North Korea got socialism, and South Korea got freedom. The first thing you do is you get food. Get food. You don't build cars and air conditioners until you get food first. That's the very. Over the last 5 years, 2.5 million people have starved in North Korea. They walk along their dusty roads, bent over. They eat sticks and plants and things just to try to fill up their stomachs. In South Korea, same heritage, culture, language, climate, the 10th largest GDP in the world. What makes a difference? Freedom makes a difference. Now, the question would be this. Why would a person make their country poor? Good question, because that was my next point. The reason is how you view man. And if you view man in your worldview, if you believe that man is an accident and he just got here, then you believe that man is in control. If you believe that God created man, then you view man entirely differently. Secondly, if you believe that man has got here on his own, he just crawled up out of the slime and said, let's write a symphony. And so in the process of having done that, then you believe that man is basically good. By what standard would he not be good? So if you believe that man is basically good, then that's different than if you believe that man is in need of a savior. If a man is basically good and something goes haywire, then it can't be his fault. It's got to be his environment's fault. So you need more government to fix things because he's basically good. And so if someone comes in here and starts shooting people and he's a good person, it can't be his fault. It's got to be the gun's fault. We've got to regulate that gun. Or if people are not... You get the picture. And finally, if you believe that man got here on its own, then his rights and power come because of his group. Because collectively, he has power. So these people always talk about gay or Hispanic or women or whatever because of the group. And yet, America was distinctly different because he said their rights don't come because of the group that they belong to. He said the rights came from God. We hold these truths a truth. Now, that's enough to get you fired about most colleges, but nevertheless, we hold these truths to be self-evident. In our birth certificate, our Declaration of Independence says this. We hold these truths to be self-evident, which is a gracious Jeffersonian way of saying any idiot ought to understand this. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator. Not because they're left-handed, or not because they're 6'2", or not because they're, but because God made. Not because they're smart or because they're not smart. Not because they're good-looking or not good-looking. It doesn't make any difference. Because God made them. It doesn't work. I wouldn't take it if I were you. All right. Don't pay any attention to the man behind the curtain here. That's all right. I'm halfway through. All right. So, if... We need to close him down. Okay. Here we go. So, if rights come from because of their group, then you view public policy significantly differently. You will look for more government to control people. And these people will want less government because they believe that each man is unique and he can write and invent and create and do things, not because of his skin color, not because it doesn't make any difference. We don't care if who writes the software. It just makes it because who they are. He's running. Let's see how many mistakes I've made. Oh, well, this is cute. Now it's up there, but it's not here. Meanwhile, back at the ranch. So these people will always want more government. These people will always want less. How do you get more government? More taxes. These people will always want more taxes, whether running for mayor or for school board or for Congress. They'll always want more taxes. These people will want fewer taxes. These people will always want a stronger defense, a weak defense. They want to take lots of money, but not for defense. These people will want a strong defense. Now people say, no, wait. You said you wanted smaller government, you want lower taxes, and yet you always want a strong defense. The answer to that is yes. And the reason for it is because look at the chart. It says, You guys are so good to stay with me. Okay. See, underneath there is we're not interested in the size of the government necessarily. We know that a smaller government gives us more freedom. And fewer taxes gives us more freedom because we have more choices. And a strong defense protects our freedom. Final example. These people will always want diverse lifestyles. These people, because they believe in God, will always believe in traditional family values. Now, once you understand those three things, those four things, you can tell me how a person stands on the Strategic Defense Initiative. Now, the Strategic Defense Initiative is an idea that says that if someone is shooting a missile to us, it would be good if we shot it down before it hit us. There were 18 candidates for president. All of them on this side said, that's a good idea. We should shoot it before it hits us. Every one of the eight on this side said, no. If China or Iran sends a missile toward America by accident or design, we would like for it to hit. Therefore, they oppose a strategic defense initiative. So you tell me where a person stands on defense, and I will tell you within a 90% certainty where they stand on taxes. Because it's the way that you view the world. It's the way that you view man, which gets back to the final point, and that is our worldview of how we view God. Now, I really, really hope. I really need it at this point. I really need this part because I didn't memorize it. The clicker, it doesn't do it, sweetheart. It died. And the quote that I have, I don't have because I was going to rely upon that. And so, look at this. Are we making headway? Glory. Hallelujah. Some of you are old enough to remember when they used to have these big rolls of film that we used to show with projectors on Sunday night. And there never was a time in the history of man on a Sunday night that you did that it didn't break down. It flop, 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 and they turned the lights back on. And if you're young, you had to wake up and everything. So we are rounding third, heading for home. Here we go. And so, as I said, you show me where a person stands on a strategic defense. I'll tell you. You show me where a person stands on passing out condoms in the classroom, and I'll tell you as to where they stand. You understand the difference. Let's go on. The next point is, what brought this nation to this place? Our nation got together, and they came up with an understanding that our rights come from God. But then they all got their independence, but their government wasn't working so well. And so, under the leadership of George Washington and Alexander Hamilton, they invited delegates from each of the 13 states that had now been independent for a decade, and let's come back, and we've got to work together to put a country together. Can we do that? And so they met in this room. Now, this is the same room where they had written the Declaration of Independence some 12 years before. And they met for the purpose of establishing a new government, and they could agree upon absolutely nothing. For 6 weeks, they met and agreed upon absolutely nothing. And so they began to break apart in the summer of 1787. And George Mason, he was George Washington's best friend and next-door neighbor, got in his carriage and started to leave. George Washington walked along beside him, pleading, said, don't leave, George. He said, George, I got things to do. And he said, well, but if we don't do it, we'll never have this chance again. And so they corral him back into that room again. And a fellow by the name of Benjamin Franklin. Now, Benjamin Franklin was one of only three people that had been there for the Declaration of Independence. He had then negotiated the peace treaty with Britain and the Treaty of Paris in 1783. And he had founed the University of Pennsylvania and all the things that he'd done, been governor of Pennsylvania. But now he's in his 80s. He had not said a word. But he saw that this wasn't working. He was recognized as a leader. And so he began with these words. He got up to speak for the very first time, having seen that they could not make any progress. Half of the people lived in three states. Half of the people lived in 10 states. There's no way around that. Little states say we're not going to be run by the big ones. The big ones say we're not going to let little people tell us what to do. They couldn't agree. Five states said, we want to have slavery. People said, we didn't fight independence to have slavery. This isn't going to work. And so they said, they couldn't agree to nothing. And finally, Benjamin Franklin said this. He said, Mr. President, the small progress that we have made after 4 or 5 weeks is proof of the imperfection of human understanding. We've gone back to ancient history for models of government, examined the different forms which now no longer exist. Let me tell you this. Wisdom is the proper use of knowledge. Wisdom comes from experience, either your own or someone else's. But there are some things that nobody's ever experienced before. And so the scripture says, if any man lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men liberally and doesn't scold us for asking. And so if you've never gone through the 12th year of a marriage with an 8-year-old and a 7-year-old before, then you need to look to God for direction. And so he said this, we have gone back to ancient history for models. We've looked at what everybody else has done of governments and examined the different forms which now no longer exist. We've viewed modern states all around Europe. We find none of their constitutions suitable for our circumstances. In this situation, groping in the dark to find political truth, we have not once thought of humbly applying to the Father of Lights to illuminate our understanding. And we're crawling around here in the dark and nobody has bothered to go over and flip on the lights. See, in the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection. Our prayers were heard and they were graciously answered. And have we now forgotten this powerful friend? Now, this isn't 230 years later. This is only 12 years later. And he has to ask the question, have we now forgotten this powerful friend? Or do we imagine that we no longer need his assistance? Because we're smart. We got it all figured out. Sir, I've lived a long time. The longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. If a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We've been assured in the sacred writings that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this, that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. I therefore move that prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessing on our deliberations be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business. And so with that... with that, the Congress went across to the church for 3 days of fasting and prayer. They reconvened the following Monday morning. And then in the following 6 weeks, they put together the Constitution of the United States of America, the oldest government on the planet. Every government on earth has changed since that time. It's been available as a template to all of them before. I believe that it's the apex in human government. And so they said, since we have done this, what made this work? Calling upon God in prayer. Therefore, let us make sure that Congress never meets again, not once, not for 5 minutes. If the House of Representatives meets today to take a message from the Senate or the President, the Speaker will walk in, bang the gavel, they'll ask God's blessing, they'll accept the message, bang the gavel, and adjourn. Congress has never met for one moment from that day until this without first calling upon God in prayer. No position of public trust, whether dog catcher or President of the United States, a person does not take a position of public trust without first calling upon God and recognizing, putting his hand upon the Bible. No official document has been written in the history of the United States, but what it does it first say, done in this, the year of our Lord, and of the independence of the United States, and it states the amount of history. And that recognition that under no circumstances does America believe that its might or its power, its wealth is going to what makes it unique, it is directly tied to God. That is what makes it powerful. Therefore, that's what makes us respect life. That's why people escape from all over the world to come here. It doesn't make any difference what religion or background they are. They know that they can get under the umbrella of the United States because it respects God and life and liberty. Now, let's quickly say, now notice the sequence there. Life, then liberty. See, liberty is of precious little value if you're dead. So you have to protect life. You don't need to know a whole lot about a person's politically. If they're not willing to protect life because God gave it, then they are not going to represent the reputation that made America unique. If you want to take away life, then you no longer need to acknowledge God. And when you take away God, then America becomes just like everybody else. And for those people that say they don't believe in God, they will work night and day to try to make sure they don't have God in the pledge or the Ten Commandments on the walls or in the monuments or Judeo-Christian symbols in city seals. They want to stop prayer in the school or at ball games or graduation. They want to ban the Boy Scouts and Salvation Army and censor historical documents. Why? They are affecting to establish their state religion of atheism over top of the faith in God that made America the unique hope for the rest of the world. John Adams said, "We have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion." You take the Bible out of the schools and you're going to need to have the policemen in there. You take the Bible out of the community responsibilities and you're going to have to build prisons left and right. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and a religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other. And then reason and experience both forbid us to expect that national morality could prevail in exclusion of religious principle. A person who wishes to attack the scriptures or spiritual representation in our national government is not a patriot, according to George Washington. And so, the final conclusion observation would be this. Some 200 years ago, Alex Tyler said the average age of the world's great civilizations have been 200 years. These nations have progressed throughout this sequence. Number one is that they find themselves in bondage, and so they cry out to God for spiritual truth. And the scripture then says that the wicked flee when no man pursueth, but the righteous are as bold as a lion. And when there's spiritual truth, then you get great courage. Righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. When the wicked beareth rule, the people mourn. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord. And so when God is in charge, then spiritual truth leads to great courage. Great courage leads to liberty. And liberty then leads to abundance. Now, 20 minutes ago, I said the greater the freedom, the greater the wealth. 200 years ago, he said the greater the liberty, the greater the abundance. That's what makes us unique, built upon that standard. Now, when you begin to think that it came from what you did and not what God did, then you want to keep, well, just protect what I got, and I don't want to be involved in working real hard, and besides, I don't want to get involved. And so when complacency then leads to apathy, what's the difference between complacency? Complacency is, I don't want to get involved. Apathy is, I don't care. I just don't care. You know, I appreciate it, Pastor, that you got to, you know, you want to get involved in this, in these initiatives and all that kind of thing, but, you know, I just really don't, well. Then after apathy comes dependence. I'm just going to vote for the person that's going to give the free pharmacist the pharmaceuticals to grandma and help Johnny get to college. And if government will do that for me, that's all I care about. And then you go from dependency back into bondage. And there is a fellow by Rabbi Lappin said some years ago, he said he knows of only one nation that ever going through that cycle has ever been called back. And that was the nation of Israel. To which I say, and there was only one other nation founded on the Word of God, and that's the United States of America. It is depending upon godly direction, and when we call upon God, He will heal our land. Seven minutes, and I'm through. This is at the request of the pastor. He wanted me to acknowledge the fact that when we don't get involved, it doesn't mean that problems go away. When people say, well, you know, I just want to hide. Why can't we just withdraw? Well, after World War I, that's what the world wanted to do. A fellow by the name of Adolf Hitler became Chancellor of Germany, and they had already prescribed at the end of the World War I in the Treaty of Versailles, it said that, you know, you've run over too many people, so we're going to create a demilitarized zone right there along the Rhineland, and you can't put any troops in there because that'll be a free fire zone. We'll know that'll be like a tripwire. Once you start moving into there, then we know you're coming after us, and so therefore we're not going to allow you to militarize the Rhineland. Adolf Hitler said, I don't think they have the character to enforce it. Let's find out. Now, Germany had no military at all. It had just come through a war, been absolutely smashed. In fact, France, the military of France was 11 times greater than the military of Germany. That tells you how small Germany's military was. Just France alone was 11 times greater. So all you had to do, in fact, when Hitler sent his troops, he decided to go into the Rhineland. He had each one of the soldiers to have retreatment orders on their person. So if they met any resistance at all, they were to immediately withdraw because they had such an eensy-weensy little army, he couldn't afford to lose it. And so he walked into the Rhineland, and the leadership of Europe did nothing. And so he said, we'll see what's next. And so he went down, and he went into the Sudetenland. And first of all, let me say he went into Austria. He had the leader of Austria murdered, and by accident he came roaring in to save the day and said, I'll help you out. And so he took over Austria, and then that left Czechoslovakia in between. Now, over in Britain, over here, was a fellow by the name of Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill had been frozen out of government. He wasn't allowed to participate. He would stay down at his house, but he could see what those guys were up to, and he said nasty things about Adolf Hitler, and Adolf Hitler said nasty things back because Adolf Hitler knew that Churchill could understand what he was doing. All these other weak little folks didn't understand, but so they went back and forth until finally Churchill said, he's going after Czechoslovakia. Do you understand that? He's got Czechoslovakia on the north. He's got Czechoslovakia on the south. He's got on the west. He's going after Czechoslovakia. And so he goes into this area called the Sudetenland, which is partly a lot of German-speaking folks, and he took it to see what they would do, and people said they got exercised, but they didn't do anything. And so he said, well, let's see how much further we go. And Churchill said, he's going after the whole country. And everybody said, well, I think you're probably right at this point. So if he goes into Czechoslovakia, that will mean war. That will mean war. And so everybody, they all had their conferences, and they all puffed up their chests, and they patted each other and said, yes, sir, he goes into Czechoslovakia, that means war. So by this time, it's 1938, and so Hitler says, let's see. He's now been head for 5 years, and he's just building tanks right and left. And Churchill said, he's not making those tanks for parades, let me tell you. And they said, no, no. And so he goes into Czechoslovakia in March of 1938, and they said, well, this means war. Absolutely, this means war. You can't believe how much war this means. This really means war. And so they said that in March, and they said it in April, and they said it in May, and they said it in June, and they said it in July. Now, in August, poor old Hitler's getting bored. Everybody's saying this means war, and nobody doing anything. And so he invites the leadership of Europe, and particularly the Prime Minister of Britain, he invites him down to the Berchtesgaden, which is Berchtesgaden. That's the best I can do. I'm from Ohio. Okay. He invites him down to his summer retreat in Munich, up in the mountains. He invites him down, and they have a little talk. And so Neville Chamberlain's the Prime Minister of Britain. He's never been in an airplane before. He flies down there to go. Now, it should be the other way around, right? They should be calling Hitler on the carpet. But nevertheless, they all fly down to go see him. And while they're sitting there, he says, I know, Mr. Prime Minister, I know you're a little upset, but let me just tell you this. I'm not going to take any more countries. He said, oh, really? So he's a good lawyer. He says, tell me, Herr Hitler, would you put that in writing? And his foreign minister says in his memoirs, he said, Hitler literally leapt for his pen. He said, oh, you want it in writing? Sure. So he writes it down. And Neville Chamberlain gets in his plane. He flies back. It's in every history book in the world. You've all seen it where he's standing there by his... He holds up, I have the Führer's signature in my hand. It's peace in our time. Peace in our time. They went to Churchill. Everybody just thought he was the hero of the world. Every newspaper in the world, front page, peace in our time. He tries to go to Parliament. The crowds are so horrendous, he can't even turn into Downing Street. He goes over to the places clapping and cheering. They think it's wonderful. They go up to Churchill. They said, what do you think? See now, you said you're going to have trouble. He's found peace in our time. Churchill said the Prime Minister faced a very difficult choice, whether to choose war or shame. And he's chosen both. And so, on September 1st, 1939, 12 o'clock at night, Adolf Hitler marched into Poland, and that's considered the start of World War II. And over the course of the battles, 55 million people died. The proper leadership at the proper time could have prevented it. When Churchill and Roosevelt were having dinner one time, the First World War was called the Great War, the war to end all wars. The war to make the world safe for democracy. Roosevelt said to Churchill, he said, what do you think they're going to call this war? Churchill said they should call it the unnecessary war. Because had there been somebody in charge at the right time, it wouldn't have happened. Now let's fast forward to 1993. In 1993, those American soldiers are in Somalia. A new president comes in and says, we're going to put them under control of foreign powers. We're going to put them under the United Nations, controlled by the Islamic Pakistanis. American soldiers, take off your helmets and your American flag and put on the blue helmet of the United Nations. And so when they were attacked, as you've all seen the movie Black Hawk Down, there was nobody to come to the aid of the Americans. And for 2 days, they're being slaughtered. And finally, some American cooks commandeer enough equipment to go out and try to rescue them. 19 of them died. Their bodies were drugged through the streets, and then the new fresh president withdrew, and that scenario was then broadcast throughout the Islamic world. See, the Americans do not have proper leadership to stand up for themselves. You poke them, they'll turn and run. And so in 1993, the World Trade Center, under the direction of Osama bin Laden, sent one of his emissaries with a truck bomb to park in the proper place to bring down the World Trade Tower to knock into the next one, but the guard made him move it to the other outside wall, and while it blew up and killed 8 people and injured 1,000, it still stood. And in 1996, they blew up the Saudi Arabian Khobar Towers, killing American soldiers. And then American embassies in Nairobi, Kenya, and in Dar es Salaam, within 5 hours, both of them were destroyed by this same Islamic terrorist in 1998, killing over 500 people, and the United States leadership did nothing. And then 2 years later, they blew up the USS Cole, American Navy ship on the high seas, and the United States did nothing. And then in 2001, they commandeered 4 airplanes and flew them into, 2 of them into the World Trade Center, 1 of them into the White House intentionally, but they, if you've ever been inside of a cockpit, you know you can't see down. You can only see out. And with the trees, they flew over the White House 3 or 4 times and couldn't find it, went into an alternate site into the Pentagon. And the 4th one was to come up the mall and take out the Capitol of the United States, that symbol of freedom. But Americans are people who could stop and think for themselves. They're not like the people that are robots, that they can only do what they were told to do. In World War II, you want to talk about a lack of intelligence. They were in the battle with Britain and with Germany, and Hitler took all of his resources at Christmas time in 1944 and had an offensive that they didn't expect would happen. And they broke through the lines and created a bulge, leaving lots of Americans behind the enemy lines with no communications, no command and control, no nothing, but they were Americans. They believed in freedom. They knew that God had made them special and they could think and act for themselves. And you've seen the movie The Dirty Dozen and others. They knew what to do. They go blow up this bridge and stop that railroad and get that energy dump. And in the process, they said that at the end of World War II, the Allies had a special secret weapon. It was called the American GI, the American soldier that could think and act for himself. That's what Americans do. And so it's September 11th. It's September 11th, 2001. And these people are doing something that has never been done before. Everybody, you thought that people wanted to, just common sense, just natural humanity would be such that a person would want to survive. The reason we had detente during the Cold War was that the Soviet Union and the United States had guns pointed at each other and said, you pull one trigger, I'll get you. And they said, no, we don't want to do that. These people are intentionally killing others and killing themselves. And in just a matter of hours, they've killed 3,000 at the World Trade Center. Now they've gone into the Pentagon. And the word breaks back to the airplane over Pennsylvania that's been hijacked and coming back, that on the cell phone they discover what has happened. These people are going to kill other people. And unless we stop them, who knows how much damage they're going to be. They wanted to take that dome and wipe it off the face of the earth. That's what they were. But the people in the airplane didn't know that. And so in the 9/11 report, they described what happened when these just plain Americans, nobody special, just Americans. This is what they did. 5 paragraphs. Let me read. During at least 5 of the passengers' phone calls, information was shared on Flight 93 about the attacks that had occurred earlier that morning at the World Trade Center. 5 calls described the intent of passengers and surviving crew members to revolt against the hijackers. According to one call, they voted on whether to rush the terrorists in an attempt to retake the plane. They prayed. They decided. And they acted. At 9:57, the passenger assault began. Several passengers had terminated phone calls with loved ones in order to join the revolt. One of the callers ended her message as follows. Everyone's going to first class. I've got to go. Goodbye. The cockpit voice recorder captured the sounds of the passenger assault muffled by the intervening cockpit door. In response, Jara immediately began to roll the airplane to the left and to the right, attempting to knock the passengers off balance. At 9:58:57, Jarwa told another hijacker in the cockpit to block the door. Jarwa continued to roll the airplane sharply left and right, but the assault continued. 9:59:52, Jarwa changed tactics and pitched the nose of the airplane up and down to disrupt the assault. The recorder captured the sounds of loud thumps, crashes, shouts, and breaking glass and plates. At 3 seconds after 10, Jarwa stabilized the airplane. 5 seconds later, Jarwa asked, "Is that it? Shall we finish it off?" A hijacker responded, "No, not yet. When they all come, we finish it off." The sounds of fighting continued outside the cockpit. Again, Jarwa pitched the nose of the airplane up and down. At 26 seconds after 10, a passenger in the background said, "Into the cockpit. If we don't, we'll all die." 16 seconds later, a passenger yelled, "Let's roll." Jarwa stopped the violent maneuvers at about 1 minute after 10 and said, "Allah is the greatest. Allah is the greatest." He then asked another hijacker in the cockpit, "Is that it? I mean, shall we put it down?" To which the other replied, "Yes, put it down. Pull it down." The passengers continued their assault until 2 minutes and 23 seconds after 10. A hijacker again said, "Pull it down, pull it down." The hijackers remained at the controls, but must have judged that the passengers were only seconds from overcoming them. The airplane headed down. The control wheel was turned hard to the right. The airplane rolled onto its back, and one of the hijackers began shouting, "Allah is the greatest. Allah is the greatest." With the sounds of the passenger counterattack continuing, the aircraft plowed into an empty field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, at 580 miles per hour, about 20 minutes flying time from Washington, D.C. Jarwa's objective had been to crash his airliner into that symbol of the American Republic, the dome of the Capitol of the United States of America. They were defeated by the alerted, unarmed Americans of United Flight 93. That's the heritage that we stand on the shoulders of those that have gone before. That's who Americans are. They know God, they love God, they respect life, and that way they are a refuge to the world. I conclude with this. It was August 24, 1814. First Lady of the land, Dolly Madison, was fixing lunch for her husband, who was battling the British in the War of 1812, when a messenger came running in as they were preparing lunch and said that President Madison was not coming to lunch, but the British were. With that, they scrambled into their carriages and left. The British came in, ate the lunch, and then that evening opened the windows, shot arrows through the windows, and put the city and the White House to the torch and burned it to the ground, all but the remaining stone walls. They continued to sack the flames, leaving scars until they could be seen 40 miles away in the third largest city of America, Baltimore. The war had broken out over Britain's attempts to regulate and tell Americans what to do, but the independence-minded United States was unwilling to endure war rather than to submit to their oppression. The British soldiers, while they were withdrawing from Washington, took a prisoner of war, Dr. William Beanes, who resided in the nearby town of Upper Marlboro. As they're marching through Upper Marlboro, the citizens, the Americans, came out along the side and heckled them as they're going through as this opposition army. And they stole their local doctor, Dr. Beanes, who was much revered in the area. The townsfolk went to an attorney by the name of Francis Scott Key and asked him to try to get the British to return their doctor. Learning that he had been held on the British flagship, Key then asked permission from the president to negotiate with the British, and so President Madison approved the mission, sending along Colonel John Skinner as an official agent for the prisoner exchange. On the morning of September 3rd, Francis and Colonel Skinner set sail for Baltimore Harbor to meet the British fleet flying a flag of truce. Now, at first, the commanders refused to release Dr. Beanes, but Key and Skinner produced a pouch of letters written by the wounded British prisoners, praising the care that they had received from the Americans, particularly Dr. Beanes, who respected life. Finally, the British officers relented, but would not release the three Americans immediately, fearing that they had heard too much of the preparations for the attack that was about to take place on Baltimore. So they placed her under guard, told that they would have to wait for the battle of the British fleet to end. Now, let me just for a moment jump back to a year before. Americans knew that if they refused to capitulate to the demands of the British, that Britain would again invade and attack their young country. Fort McHenry was the star-shaped military protection overlooking the Baltimore Harbor, America's busiest seaport, and the commander was a young man by the name of George Armistead. And he felt confident that Americans did not capitulate, the British would come after their country, that the attack would take place in his domain, and he was certain that Fort McHenry would be the center of the battle. So anticipation of that, so that the British would have no trouble locating his location, he went to marry young Pickersgill. and asked her to make the largest flag ever, using 400 yards of the best wool bunting, cutting 15 stars, measuring 2 feet from point to point, 8 red and 7 white stripes, each one 2 feet wide, making a banner 42 feet by 30 feet. Now back to the following year. 7 a.m., the morning of September 13, 1814, the British bombardment of Fort McHenry began, and the flag was ready to meet the enemy. The bombardment continued all day and all night. The British fired 1,500 bombshells that weighed as much as 220 pounds, carried lighted fuses that were supposed to explode once they'd reached their target. However, they weren't always dependable, and they would explode in midair. From special small boats, the British also fired new concrete rockets that would trace a wobbly arc of red flame throughout the sky. Now hear this. The Americans, not soldiers, not sailors, just plain God-fearing, freedom-loving Americans, had taken 22 of their own vessels and sunk them in the entrance to the harbor so the British couldn't enter. That made a close approach impossible, hence they had to use the rockets. Francis Scott Key, Colonel Skinner, Dr. Bean watched the battle with apprehension. They knew that as long as the shelling continued, Fort McHenry had not surrendered. But long before daylight, there came a sudden and mysterious silence. What they did not know was that the British assault on Baltimore had begun as well as the naval attack. And those same patriots, those same Americans who had sunk their own vessels in the harbor entrance, had then positioned themselves in the marshes along the side where the enemy would have to go to reach the city. And finding such resistance and opposition more than they could handle, the British officers ordered a retreat. And then in the pre-dawn darkness, Key waited for the sight that would end his anxiety. The joyous sight of Major Armistead's flag blowing in the breeze. And then, when at last, by the early light of dawn, they could begin to make out what indeed the flag was still there. Being a hymn composer, feeling uniquely inspired, Key began to write on the back of a letter that he had in his pocket, "Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we had hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars o'er the ramparts we watch were so gallantly streaming?" And the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave? And then he concluded with this verse, thinking about us here tonight. He said, "Oh, thus be it ever that free men shall stand between their loved homes and the war's desolation. Blessed with victory and peace, may this heaven-rescued land praise the power that has made and preserved us a nation. Then conquer we must when our cause it is just. Let this be our motto: in God is our trust. And the star-spangled banner in triumph will wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave."
Oh, we see, can you